Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Marcus Kane. Marcus is an eating disorder informed nutrition and stress management coach who specialises in binge eating recovery. Through private coaching and the Strong Not Starving podcast, he provides coaching and resources to help people leave behind binge eating, navigate struggles with body image, manage stress, and create fulfilling relationships with food and exercise. This week, we talk all about eating disorders in men and the impact that overtraining and dietary restrictions can have on hormones, body composition, and how we can work towards recovery together. Hi, Marcus. It's so nice to have you back on the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm really well, Hannah. Thank you. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. It's so nice to see you again. It's funny because I think now Full of Beans is like 3.5 years old. I've had quite a few people recently, they've been like, oh, can we do an episode again? And I'm like, yes, I want to see the familiar faces again.
Yeah, I've been really looking forward to doing this. I really enjoyed our first couple of conversations. That was like, it was like 2021, 2022 or something like that.
Was it?
Oh my God. It's been a while.
The COVID.
Like in that kind of weird medium kind of post-COVID, still COVID, but people saying it's not COVID, like that. We haven't really caught up in this area since then. So I've been really looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, and it's lovely. And I think it's really interesting because if we think back to when we both met the first time, I think both of kind of our focuses or our lives have changed quite a lot. So it's really nice to come back now and kind of be looking at things from a different angle, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I know a lot's changed. Like you're currently selling a house. I just bought a house. I feel like we're doing a lot of very adult stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
I said to my mum the other day, I was like, I feel like Hannah a year ago was a very unwell, poorly girl. And girl, I think I have to use the word girl. And I said to her, I was like, I am now like selling this house, which is my partner's house, but like we're buying a house together. I'm self-employed. I'm like, I feel like a woman, like, you know, the recovery has given me that. And it's so nice. And I think like this time last year, if you just said to me, you'd be referring to yourself as a woman, I'd be like, oh my God, that's terrifying. I don't want to be a woman. That's disgusting. Like, none of that. And now I'm like, oh, I'm thriving as a woman.
It's been so amazing to see your journey and kind of be a part of that, like vicariously, and see bits and pieces, because you've been so inspiring through the years that we've known each other, and your work is just so insightful and so wonderful. I've been able to share it with so many people, so it's always really nice to hear you're in a good place.
Yeah, that's really kind of you. Thank you. Yeah, it's strange because it kind of, I always kind of thought, oh, something like significant would happen and then I would recover, and it kind of like just happened. Like I went, it sounds so bougie, but I went on holiday to Indonesia for a wedding, and in the first week, like, well, in the whole holiday, there was no access to kind of making your own food. And genuinely, I kept saying to my partner, I need to go somewhere, like I need to go to a day patient basically, and I need to be fed my meals and not have access to exercise. And when we were in Indonesia, we had to have like every meal out, and I did still have access to exercise, but not to the gym. And I came back from my holiday and I remember saying to my therapist, I feel like I've kind of started things properly now and I kind of just need to carry on. And she was like, you got two choices really, you kind of go back to where you were or you carry on down this path. And I was like, actually can't be asked to go back to where it was before. I feel like I've got a little bit more energy now.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to go back. People say, oh, it's, you know, it's so challenging moving forward and everything like that. But yeah, as well, it's a lot of work to go back in the other direction.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Something that people often ask me is like, oh, how long will it take? When will I know when I'm, quote, recovered? Almost expecting this light bulb moment where we wake up one morning and go, oh, goodness, I'm there.
Yeah. But
I definitely noticed that for me, it was all in kind of like hindsight. I just woke up one morning and realized, oh, it's actually been quite a few months since I thought about food or my body in the way that I was. And I didn't really recognize progress when it was happening. I only recognized it when I started reflecting, almost that gap versus gain mentality, like recognizing how far I've come rather than trying to comprehend how far I still have to go. And I only really started noticing that I've made progress when I started employing that and going, wow, actually, okay, a few months ago, things were different.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, it's also noticing like what the changes that have happened now. Like, for example, I mentioned to you before we started the podcast, I went to a festival on the weekend and we like got sandwiches on the train before we went. And then at like 4 o'clock, I was hungry. And my partner was like, oh, I kind of want some food. And then all the artists that we wanted to watch were on from like five. And he was like, should we get some food now? I was like, yeah, okay, I'll have some chips. And then when we were coming back on the train later, I was like, oh my God, I just like had some chips. Like, I've never eaten at a festival before. And it was just, and it was at 4 o'clock, whereas normally I'd be like, no, I have to have my dinner at X time. And I think it is just realizing those little things of being like, whoa, like, you know, there was still a little bit of apprehension and afterwards there was still a bit of guilt, but like, I did it. And before that wouldn't have been something I could have even attempted to do. So I think for me, that's what it is like realizing, oh my God, I just did that thing kind of normally. Which is amazing.
That's so wonderful and so amazing, because I remember going to festivals with like 90s style cargo shorts on, loaded with protein bars.
Well, you're not allowed to take food in.
Really? Not anymore. Okay, so this was back in the 1600s when I was going to festivals. And
yeah, so normally that's what I would do if it was like a festival, like a long one, because it's a day one, you're not allowed to take any food in. So it's kind of annoying in the sense that then you have to spend quite a lot of money. But it's also good to challenge recovery as well.
Well, yeah, that's it. Like, this is so cool that you were able to, you know, eat what was available and everything, because I just remember trying to force myself to live on the provisions that I'd put into my pockets. And it was never satisfying. It was always awful. Congratulations on having that experience.
Thank you. Yeah, no. So for the podcast, my recovery aside, which is nice to chat about, would you like to, for the people that maybe haven't heard of you before or just need a refresh about who you are and what you do, would you like to just give them an intro to yourself?
Sure. So my name's Marcus. I run a platform called Strong Not Starving, and primarily I focus on helping people make their way out of struggles with binge eating. But through that journey, I had to educate myself and become very informed on all kinds of eating disorders. So mostly I work with people struggling with binge eating, but also I've had to go down the rabbit holes of understanding things like, you know, anorexia, bulimia, all other kinds of eating disorders. I myself struggled with anorexia in my teenage years, which then became bulimia in my 20s, which then morphed into binge eating disorder in my late 20s. It took me about 15 years to make my way back from struggling with eating disorders, just because I couldn't find the kind of help that really resonated with me. And so now I aim to give people like me a bit of a shortcut. So I'm trying to provide the kind of resource that really would have helped me back in the day. And that's what Strong Not Starving is.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think, you know, it's so common, isn't it, for people that kind of have been struggling to not be able to find that support they need. And because you've almost got that sort of insight into what it was that you needed, obviously that might not be the same for everybody. But you've got that kind of level of understanding of actually, you know, the quote unquote classic or kind of the recommended treatment doesn't always work for everybody. And, you know, you do need to explore different things. So it's great that you're able to do that now for your clients. So very excited today. I don't think this is a topic that we hear about a lot. And I was reflecting the other week and I was like, I need to do more stuff for men. Which actually, now I've reflected on it, I've had like five men in a row, which have been great. So I obviously put that in my mind of I'm going to get men on the podcast, and I did. So that's great. But we were going to talk about hormonal changes in men. And I guess maybe to start with, and obviously I don't want to kind of like do stereotypes for male eating disorders, but is there particular things that you see when you work with male clients in terms of specific behaviors, or is it kind of very across the board, and you know, it's kind of anything can occur for men.
Anything really can occur for men, just in different ratios usually to what I see in women, and research backs this up as well, that in men there's a lot more kind of compensation with exercise. There's maybe less of a focus on restriction, though restriction is very present. I don't want to mix that up, but yeah, restriction is present. All the same symptoms that we see in women are present, but it's almost like the emphasis is on different areas. Of course, with men, there's the pressure surrounding muscularity and looking a certain way kind of athletically, which requires a certain approach to training. It requires a slightly different mindset. It makes us focus on slightly different things. So with men, there's often a bigger focus on compensation through exercise. There is the added problematic area of like the bulking kind of phase, like, you know, that we see in, you know, trying to eat as much as possible to put on muscle mass, and that can become very problematic when it's tied into a cycle of, you know, restriction to try and, you know, lose body fat and then put muscle on. And yeah, it's all the same things that we see in women, but the emphasis is on different areas, so it skews the experience a little bit.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you said that, because I think that there's been kind of this big sort of push towards, oh, male eating disorders equal muscularity focused things, and I think that there definitely is a, you know, there's a lot of people out there struggling with muscularity orientated disordered eating that are going kind of, I guess, unnoticed because it's so normalized. It's actually, I was at a festival the other day, and one of my friends has got really lean recently, and the amount of people that came up to him and were like, oh mate, you look sick, yeah, like, your body's amazing, da, 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 da. And you know, I think they obviously do it for, they're doing it because they want to compliment him, and they're doing it because they at the end of the day, like, as much as I don't know where I sit with it, like, he has worked really hard in the gym for years and years and years, and he's crafted, you know, a very good physique that, you know, if within bodybuilding would be brilliant and admired. But I think it's difficult when you then separate it out in terms of, like, I fear that, you know, his personality now and his self-worth is so tied into the way that he looks, when you've got people commenting on, you know, how muscular you are, how big your muscles are, and things like that. It's then kind of shifting into, if you lost that muscle, then what happens?
And that's the big question, isn't it? I'm very much in the same boat as you. I know a lot of people who do a lot of things that would be considered disordered through certain lenses, but they do it with a particular intention. It doesn't really go to like a dark kind of place for them, and that's just their journey. That's cool. They're doing a lot of these things through the lens of enthusiasm and a love of training and curiosity about dieting, and that's great, but it's a really fine line. When I first got into this space, I became very, very black and white and was saying, okay, nobody should be doing this. Nobody should be doing that. This is always disordered. That is always healthy. This, and I've had to make peace with the fact that, okay, I've got some dear friends who do things that would be very problematic for me, but it's okay for them.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, your friend, the work he's done, that shift can start to happen where, okay, it was hard work, it was great. Maybe at one point it was coming from a place of enthusiasm and wanting to be strong and a love of the gym and everything. And then at some point, a balance tips. And the idea of being anything other than that becomes very, very scary. You know, the self-limiting decisions start appearing, life starts becoming small, and that's what we really need to look out for. We need to be kind of self-aware enough to notice, like, when that is happening, when that balance is starting to shift.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting because, I mean, I guess this is kind of off topic of what we were talking about, but I think it's equally important to reflect on, is I, in my recovery journey, exercise has remained a part throughout. I haven't stopped exercising. I've shifted how I exercise, and I've got a coach to make sure that I am not the person that is putting my training in place. And that has been something that's helped so much, because she keeps me accountable. And I do kind of like CrossFit style, like strength stuff. And you know, a lot of people could suggest that that would be, you know, something that might trigger your eating disorder. But for me, it's allowed me to stay engaged in the gym. And I have a lot of friends in the gym as well, because I've powerlifted for years, stay engaged with my friends. But I've reframed what exercise is for me. And now it's about me getting strong and, you know, me being like super impressive in the fact that, you know, I'm a 5'2" girl and I can deadlift 150 kilos. Like, that to me is something that I'm really proud of. But it's taken away the aesthetic side of it for me, because for me, the aesthetic was the side that was kind of ruining my relationship with food and exercise. And I think that's what I always say to people now in like recovery, is if you want to exercise, you just need to take a step back and think about, you know, the role that exercise is having for you in your relationship with it. If it's something that, you know, you don't feel that you can miss out on, or you put yourself down if you don't achieve things, or, you know, you've got that compulsive relationship, then maybe it's not super helpful for you in your recovery, and maybe some time out might help. But if it's allowing you to build your confidence, and, you know, I find most of the days when I go to the gym, I come home and I feel electric, and it's a feeling that I can't really get from other things. So I think it's about being unique and kind of have it. And I know that when I was in recovery, I found it triggering when people were still exercising, but I found it triggering because I was exercising in the wrong way. And I do think it's about separating yourself from the other people. Like you said, you know, your friends might do stuff that you are like, okay, that for me is not going to work. But it's about finding your balance.
Mm. And that's so true. Like, I really identify with what you just shared about exercise, because it's, and you've done extremely well, like, you know, hats off to you for keeping that perspective, like in those moments when, you know, you're in the gym doing your thing. I think it requires us to very much be able to focus on what we're doing without making it about how am I compared to other people, or what am I like. Yeah. I mean, that's just been a big part of it for me, definitely, because I, like I mentioned, I see certain friends doing things, eating in certain ways, training in certain ways that is fine for them, but it doesn't work out for me. It doesn't, on multiple levels. And there was a point in my journey when I would have been really tempted to say, oh, dude, you know, like, you got to be careful. Like, you know, any moment you're going to go down a really dark rabbit hole. And they're like, well, actually, no, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
How about you focus on you? And now I'm much better at doing that, at going, all right, that's what they're doing. That's cool. This is what works for me. This is what I'm happy with. And yeah, it has really been an exercise in kind of minding my own business.
Yeah. I think it's also a really good reflection, though. And I always say this to people when I refer to the podcast, in that there will be instances, and I assume that, you know, how I've just spoken about exercise is probably going to be quite triggering for some people. But I'm not going to not talk about it, because from my perspective, if you hear someone say something or something comes up, you think, oh, I don't like that, that's really triggering, it gives you kind of something to think, oh, maybe I need to work on that. Maybe I need to unpack my relationship with exercise, or what have you. Because I know that for me, when I found things triggering in conversations or whatever, it was always something I needed to take away and then actually think about, oh, you know, why has that triggered me? You know, is there something underlying there that's going on? And so I think often when somebody is kind of living their own life and, you know, you're thinking, oh God, they shouldn't be doing that, that's, you know, that's unhealthy, I think maybe take a step back and think, why do I think that's unhealthy? Why is that making me feel uncomfortable? Because maybe it's something that, you know, you've not quite processed yet, that needs to be unpacked and explored, to think about, okay, why do I think that that would be an unhealthy behavior? Because I know that if I did that, it would be an unhealthy behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. A really great friend of mine and I the other day were talking about the intention behind what it is we're doing, and in terms of diet specifically, whether or not the intention with any particular diet or exercise choice is something that comes from a place of compulsion or feeling not good enough and needing to change ourselves, or whether a choice comes from a place of genuine self-care and enthusiasm and like a positive place. I mean, that's definitely something that I've noticed, is the difference in maybe how I think about things now versus how I used to. Anything that I do for myself now, when it comes to food or the gym, it's always coming from a place now of, I wonder what this would be like. It feels good to be strong. Like, my wife made me promise that I've got to live for a really long time. So, okay, that's something I've got to factor in, you know, like, so yeah, all these decisions, when they start coming from a different place, I think it makes a huge difference.
As you were saying earlier about like thinking about recovery, and I mentioned, you know, having the chips, and retrospectively, I was like, oh, wow, I wouldn't have been able to do that the other day. On Saturday, I was dog sitting all of last week, and I just hadn't been sleeping because I was in someone else's house. And then I was, I guess I was doing a bit more activity than normal because of walking the dogs as well. And on Saturday, I got to the gym and I had what my coach had programmed. I got halfway through and I was like, I'm not going to make it to the festival if I carry on with this. And so I just went home. And, you know, looking back, I was like, there is no way in hell before I would have been able to come back from the gym. I would have been like, no, you've got to finish it. This is what she's programmed you. But I was able to kind of check in with my body and be like, okay, if I want to have a nice time later, this is going to be way too much. And so I think that's the thing as well, is being able to kind of listen to your body more. And, you know, if you have a day where you're like, actually, this isn't working for me today, you know, I'm not feeling this, being able to leave rather than like push through the, you know, there's all those classic saying like, pain is weakness leaving the body and all that shit. And you're like, yeah, no, no cheers.
Yeah, no. No, thanks. Yeah, no, I've been down that road. It's well marked. I didn't like it. Didn't work out for me. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we were going to talk about hormonal changes in men in terms of eating disorders. So I guess to start with, do you kind of want to explore, I guess, the different behaviors and how they can lead to hormonal changes in men?
So primarily we're looking at overtraining and intense dietary restriction, or not even intense dietary restriction sometimes, but just dietary restriction and overtraining. These are two things that are all but encouraged in the space sometimes, in the fitness space sometimes, or, you know, if they're not encouraged overtly, then we often see things that, you know, reading between the lines, it's being encouraged. They're not saying it out loud, like they're not saying go and do this, but they're not saying it, and they're presenting a whole bunch of behaviors, especially in video content and everything like that, that imply restriction and overtraining. And it's difficult because for one person, what is constructive training session for another person would be completely unsustainable and an example of overtraining. And when we do that, we experience issues with sex hormones, growth hormone sensitivity, and stress hormones like cortisol. This all pans out in such a way that it has a counterproductive effect, not just in terms of our just general health, but in terms of the process of what we're actually trying to achieve with great nutrition and training. So, yeah, men tend to lean towards dietary restriction and overtraining in slightly different ways than we might see with women, but there's a lot of overlap and there's just a slightly different emphasis on different things.
What would the differences be, do you think?
Well, of course, with men, there's the slightly greater emphasis on muscle development and strength, those kinds of things. And there's slightly more of a leaning towards, in general, this is like very, very generalized terms, compensation with exercise more so than restriction. That doesn't mean that there aren't women that don't compensate with exercise, and it doesn't mean that there aren't men who restrict. We all do like a combination of both usually, but men tend to lean a little bit more towards trying to compensate with exercise. And there can be some problematic things that start happening when we start looking at trying to hit certain protein targets for muscle mass and the whole bulking cutting thing and the cycles that starts to lead to. I've noticed that men lean into a lot more things like intermittent fasting in general, men go down the biohacking kind of bro route a little bit.
What's
more?
That?
So biohacking, things like a lot of practices that are a kind of pseudoscience-y, like for instance, with intermittent fasting, some people feel good intermittent fasting and that's fine. I don't want to try and take this away from people who feel like it's a good thing for them and that it's helping them in some way, as long as we've got some self-awareness around what clarifies as helping. Like, we could go down 1,000 different rabbit holes here, but biohacking is, you know, like the red light therapy, the saunas, the fasting, the, you know, those kind of like 1% of 1% style actions, where when we start focusing on them too much, it's very much like we're majoring in the minors. Mm-hmm. And there's not a whole lot of evidence to suggest that these things work in the way that we are told by enthusiasts of those mm-hmm. practices that they work. So mm-hmm. with intermittent fasting, for example, there used to be, still is, like a whole lot of claims around like hormones and longevity and everything like that. But the science is very flimsy. Very, very flimsy. And anyone who makes any claims about intermittent fasting in terms of like growth hormone production, you know, all that kind of stuff, it's very, very, very dicey territory.
And I think, but this is the problem with a lot of these things, is that a lot of it is a lot of pseudoscience. And also, from what I've found, is a lot of celebrities that get on the hype of some form of nutrition trend, whether it's intermittent fasting or whatever. And then because they have got like a large audience, people think that they are, you know, it's factual, it's evidence-based, and they're going to follow it. But actually, no, I'm going to scrap that. I don't even think that they think it's factual evidence-based. I think that they see the celebrity. They see the celebrity has a body type that they aspire to. Therefore, they're like, oh, well, you know, if I intermittently fast, then I'll end up looking like that. But what people forget is that these people's lives, particularly influencers or whatever, these people's lives are centered around like getting to a certain body shape and then sustaining it. They've got dietitians, nutritionists, like, you know, personal trainers, da da da. And it's probably so much more than just this one diet trend that they're telling people. But because they've got that large audience, people think they're credible and then people follow it themselves. And I think that's really risky territory when, you know, you're listening to somebody with no nutritional qualifications or anything. It's just kind of following the hype because their body looks good.
Yes. And that demographic of people, I get the sense that they become quite, what's a nice way to put it, out of touch in terms of what privileges they have with things like stress mm-hmm. management. You know, I'll use Hugh Jackman as an example. Now, I like Hugh Jackman. He seems like a wonderful guy and I'm a big fan of his work. And yes, he works hard in the gym. He's stuck to a ridiculous diet for like the latest film that he did, like the whole Deadpool and Wolverine thing. I'm not saying that that's not hard. Yes, it's hard. He worked very hard for that. But it's a different kind of hard work to the guy who is in debt up to his eyeballs, trying to manage a family with two young kids, working a job that he doesn't like very much. You know, working 12 hours a day and then barely getting time to, you know,
make a cup of tea.
Yeah, barely getting time to have 10 minutes to himself. Like these are different kinds of hard. And when we look at the things that move the needle most in terms of progress and results from any journey involving, you know, healthy food, you know, even that term can be problematic, but, you know, food and exercise and training and everything, stress management and recovery is one of the most important things that we could possibly factor in to that equation. I've even got anecdotal evidence, like myself, of times in my life that I look back on and go, wow, I was really happy with what was going on then around that time for me. But that was maybe a period in my life where I had much fewer responsibilities than I do right now. Mm. And my work to just recovery ratio was far, far more in my control than what it is right now. And we need to take these things into account.
Yeah, that's so true. I think that's the biggest thing, isn't it? Like a lot of these people that are influencers and, you know, maybe we aspire to have the body types of, they've got so much, I guess, like support around them and space for, you know, recovery, like you said. But the phrase I hate the most is like a dad bod. It's like it's just, it's so demoralizing. It neglects everything that people are going through. And also like the connotation of that being a bad thing. I think it's very much like, oh, I don't know, scaremongering in terms of, you know, this is what you'll end up like if you have kids or, you know, if you don't have that, if you, your focus isn't on the gym and things like that. And I just, yeah, it's why should we kind of prioritize the way that somebody's body looks? It's very similar, I guess, in a sense, like when a woman's pregnant and then she's expected to bounce, quote unquote, bounce back. It's like, no, like you should be focusing on it, like building that connection with your child, enjoying it, like, you know, having a brilliant time with your kids rather than trying to get your body back into a shape that potentially it might not even go back into, or it's maybe not even made to go into.
We're singing from the same songbook here. Yeah. There's nothing I can add to that. I just agree. So hard. Yeah.
I'm interested as well about, I guess, the impact of hormones. So you mentioned before, like, I think it was, I can't remember, there was cortisol and then there was some growth stimulating hormone or something. But I was just wondering, like, how the behaviors of like restriction or binge eating impact them in terms of kind of, you know, the impact later down the line, because people will always say, you know, like increased cortisol will lead to weight gain, or I guess like reduced growth hormone, I would suspect that that would be like less muscle mass. So are there like implications from experiencing those behaviors to then kind of body composition and changes down the line?
Yeah. So if we look at these three things, three fundamental things like sex hormone production, growth hormone insensitivity, and any kind of significant increases in cortisol from a sex hormone production with men, testosterone dropping to a significant degree. We've got things like muscle atrophy, like losing muscle mass, hair loss, low libido, issues with memory and cognition. So these are big issues. And they affect our lives on a daily basis. If we look at the Minnesota starvation experiment, the way this panned out in the men in that experiment, you know, things like they'd see more rigid thinking showing up in these guys. They'd see more emotional dysregulation. Because if you look at it, things like issues with memory and cognition could say that kind of translates into what most of us would call mental bandwidth, like mental energy. When we start losing these things, we start acting in ways that we don't want to act. We don't think deeply. We don't think clearly. We often think in a lot more kind of black and white, all or nothing style. With a more black and white kind of mindset, because we just don't have the energy or the bandwidth to be stopping and pausing and thinking and you know, really making good decisions. So it all starts to snowball and kind of feed into itself. And then if we look at like growth hormone insensitivity, with the number of adolescent, like young lads, like teenage boys that are wanting a six pack and everything like that right now, dietary restriction at that age, dietary restriction at that age can potentially lead to like stunted growth and all this kind of stuff. I'll never know if that affected me or not. Like my brother is 6'1", my dad is 6'3", I'm 5'11", and I went through anorexia as a teenager, followed by many years of dietary restriction. And believe me, I'll never know exactly how much that had an impact on me. So, you know, this is real. And it's easy to think, oh, that's not me, that's never going to happen to me, but like it will, something will. Mm-hmm. And when we look at medically significant increases in cortisol, one of the primary ways that that pans out is in compromised sleep. Now, compromised sleep quality is one of the first signs that we see from overtraining. So consistently exceeding our maximum recoverable volume in terms of training, our sleep gets compromised, and that can lead to a dramatically increased risk of injury during training. And we all know how much those of us who've struggled with a compulsive relationship with exercise love injuries. It becomes very, very distressing to be injured and not able to train. We end up trying to train through the injury and making it worse and potentially creating chronic injuries that we're just wrestling with, which then increases the emotional distress, the emotional dysregulation, and the distress associated with that whole experience. Compromised sleep is, again, it's negatively impacting our recovery. So we're constantly pushing for more training in the name of the goals that we're chasing while our recovery is compromised. So we're not going to be seeing the results that maybe other people with better recovery practices are seeing. And that's going to, you know, leads to all kinds of frustration and self-judgment and terrible cycles there. Not to mention, it messes with our hunger and fullness cues. So increased cortisol, and I don't want to demonize cortisol here. It is normal to have an amount of cortisol in our system. Cortisol is a normal hormone. It's regulated by the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, or the HPA axis. Now, that's a combination of three organs: the hypothalamus, pituitary gland, and the adrenal glands. They are responsible for kind of regulating that fight or flight response. So cortisol is a normal hormone to have, but when we have too much of it and it compromises our sleep, it messes with our hunger and fullness cues by messing with the hormones that regulate those cues. So I think it's leptin and ghrelin that regulate like hunger and fullness. So all of a sudden, we're at a higher risk of injury. We're not recovering from our training. We're getting terrible sleep. We're emotionally dysregulated. Our hunger cues are messed up. You know, we're at a higher risk of muscle atrophy, hair loss. Like, it takes everything that we don't want to happen and just moves the needle on it. It's an awful snowballing kind of spiraling effect.
Yeah. And I think this is the thing that people don't mention, you know, when they're in the pursuit for that body type. I don't know who it was, but I remember listening to a podcast about, it was some actor who like got really, really shredded for a movie. And he was talking about, you know, how difficult it was to, you know, maintain the diet, maintain the exercise in order to look a certain way in the movie. But so many people won't listen to that backstory. They'll just see him in the movie and be like, oh my god, he looks amazing, like I want to follow his diet plan, or I want to follow his exercise plan. But I think it's when you look at the bigger picture of the sacrifices that people have to make in order to look a certain way. And also, you know, like you mentioned, Hugh Jackman, like, you know, he did it for the movie, but I'm pretty sure he probably won't be able to sustain that body for much, you know, for a long time,
because of course not. No,
you're not kind of living in a way that allows you to do other things and to thrive. I mean, you know, he probably could do if he wanted to sacrifice everything else in his life, that's his choice. But I think, you know, when we're looking at taking a holistic view of our life, in order to pursue a particular body type, you have to sacrifice so much. And you know, it's not just about kind of, oh, I won't go to that one social event, or, you know, I won't do this, that, the other. It's sacrificing your health as well. And I think that's the scary thing, is in the moment, it's like, no, I'm doing it to pursue this body type. But actually, you don't think about the bigger picture. And you mentioned it there as well, like, oh, it'll never happen to me. And I think so many people do that in terms of, you know, people will say, oh, it's associated with this condition, da da da. And you're so fixated on looking a certain way and feel almost superhuman, I guess, that it's like, no, that'll never happen to me. Like, I totally had that about, I've not had my period for on and off 14 years. And I don't, you know, I'm in a position, I'm 27. I don't know the implications of that because I still haven't got my period back yet. But, you know, my mind is not worried about that. Like, there is no part of me that's like, oh God, you know, if my friend said to me, I've not had a period for a consistent length of time for 14 years, I'd be like, oh damn, that's probably not great for your body. But for me, it's like, no, well, you know, I'm Hannah, I'm superhuman, and, you know, I don't need to worry about that. And I know that so many other people are like that. And I think what is particularly when you're in the gym and kind of, you know, pushing yourself, pushing those limits, it's kind of, I'll do anything for it. And, you know, I am superhuman because I can push myself past these boundaries that maybe other people can't. So I don't need to worry about my health.
That's so true. For so many years, I functioned on a combination of vodka and self-hatred. You know, everyone was looking at me going, oh, you know, you're like the healthy one. Look, you're so fit. You're so this, you're so that. Where, you know, I had a drinking problem. I was doing a lot of drugs. I was exercising like a maniac. Mm-hmm. But that's because I was waking up and having like a triple espresso and a pre-workout and just going to the gym and doing all that kind of stuff. And I was miserable all the time. But I felt like I could take it. And I'm 36 right now, like turning 37 in January, closer to 40 than 30. And in my 30s, I've started to experience the ramifications of everything that I've done to myself. In my 20s, I started experiencing hair loss, and which was just like one of the worst things. You know, in my 20s, you asked me, what's the worst thing that could happen to you? And I would have said my body changing shape and losing my hair. And because of what I was doing to myself, like my hair started thinning at a very, very young age, which of course sent me insane for many, many years in terms of body image and all this kind of stuff. I'm probably, you know, genetically predisposed to a certain amount of hair loss, but that was very much sped up by certain things that I was doing to myself during that phase of my life. And even right now, we mentioned this before we started recording, the last 3 days, I've experienced just an insane episode of IBS, which occurs for me sometimes. I didn't used to get that. Growing up, I never had it. In my 20s, I never had it. But through punishing myself with diet and all this kind of stuff and extreme decisions for so long, now I've reached a point where if I make careless food choices, I can end up just out for the count for days. The nausea, I can't begin to describe all this kind of like GI irritation, nausea that's like, you know, I spent half the day on Saturday, I think it was, lying on the stairs outside my bathroom. Because essentially on Wednesday, I got really busy. I missed a couple of meals to the point where I was really, really hungry. And then the meal that we had scheduled or planned for that night was like a very, very high fiber, like salad type situation, like a big salad with a lot of fiber in it and everything. And that's not how I eat all the time. I'm not that, you know, I've moved past that. But that combination of things, like a very, very high fiber, large salad on a extremely empty stomach, just set it off. And I was out for days. It was the worst. And I always feel so terrible because then I'm like, the weekend rolls around and I feel like a bad husband because I can't go and do stuff with my wife because I'm there like lying on the stairs outside the bathroom. And she's such a sweetheart about it. You know, she's giving me all these like Polish remedies for bits and pieces. But I look at how I was treating myself and how invincible I thought I was. And it was all on borrowed time. It's like a credit card. I was running up debt that I'm paying now. And I think at one point through the whole hair loss journey, I went to see a doctor about it who did like hair transplants. And he said something to me that was just, it has stuck with me like to this day. I sat down in front of him, and at that stage, it wasn't obvious that my hair was thinning, but I could tell because I was obsessive and like analyzing myself. And there were a lot of predatory people that were selling me very expensive solutions. And I spent thousands on stuff that was just harmful and useless and didn't work. And then I finally went to this guy. He sat me down in his office, and the first thing he said to me was like, now, I want to know why a young man like yourself, who's 21, 22, is in my office and you don't look like you have a problem. And I told him about the hair transplant thing, and I'm so self-conscious because it's starting to thin a little bit on the crown of my head and all this kind of stuff. And my hair is definitely not as thick as it was when I was a teenager and yada, yada, yada. And he said to me, okay, look, some people might be willing to do a hair transplant on you right now. But the thing about that is we don't know if it's going to work very well at this age. And we get a better opportunity to see if this is a viable solution for you the older you get. And the thing that he said that really stuck with me was this. He says, I know that right now you think that you're not going to care when you're 30, that you're not going to care when you're 40 about how you look, how you feel, and that it's what's right now that matters. He's like, but trust me, you're going to care how you feel when you're 30. You're going to care how you feel when you're 40 and 50. So right now, I'm going to send you home. Come and see me in 10 years if you've still got questions. And that just stuck with me so much, this concept of you are going to care. It might feel like right now is all that matters, and you'll cross this bridge when you come to it later, and I'm not going to care later. Even in our 30s going, oh, you know, I'll cross that bridge when I'm 50. No, no, no. You're going to care. It's going to matter. And that is something that has just always stuck with me, and it's so true.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's such a good point, but it's so hard in the moment, isn't it, to think about you in 10 years' time and
yeah,
the implications and the impact that it's going to have. But it's so easy. Like, I don't know whether you get this, but me now, I'll like look back at pictures of myself a year ago, 2 years ago or whatever, and I'll be like, God, how did I think that I was overweight? Or like, how did I hate my body so much at that point? And retrospectively, you can look back, but looking forward to the future and thinking, you know, I'm still going to care and I'm still going to have issues then, I guess, is then really difficult in the moment to think about the implications of your actions now on, you know, on future you. But I actually did this really cool thing in therapy where it was like a visualization thing, and I sat down as me now. I also sat down with me in 20 years' time and me 20 years ago. And it was such a powerful thing to do because it was, I like spoke to little me and I was saying to her, like, you know, things are a bit shit right now. And, you know, this was like a year ago when I was not doing so well and stuff. And she got really upset about that. And then the realization of like that little girl, I was not the woman that she wanted to grow into. That was really powerful. But then also talking to me in 20 years' time, we kind of did it of like, you know, if you carry on this trajectory now and don't get better, what's the conversation you're going to have? Or what's the conversation going to be in 20 years' time if you do get better? And that helped me so much to kind of shift my perspective of thinking about, okay, every action I take now, whether it feels so minuscule, like having mayonnaise in my sandwich or not having mayonnaise in my sandwich, it feels like the tiniest thing. And to Joe Blogs on the street, that's probably, they wouldn't even think about it. But I know that by not having it, it's another day of restriction. But by having it, it's another day towards recovery. And then the future Hannah would be so happy. But that's so hard in the moment to think about that, especially when you've got so much fear around the impact that that's going to have on you.
It is. Yeah, it is so hard in the moment. I wish there was something I could say that was like, oh, here's like this trick that you can use to make it easier right now. And sure, you know, there are things that we can do, stress management type things and distress management type strategies that we can do to mitigate stress in the moment, and we can engage in a few practices to take something that feels impossible and make it doable. But yeah, you're right. Like it is really hard in the moment. And often when I think of things that I'm grateful for now, I know this might sound cheesy, but almost all of them come from something that was really hard that I did like 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I was at the gym the other day, actually. And normally phrases like this, I'd be like, oh, fucking hell. But the guy that said it, I actually really value. And he's a PT at my gym. And he has such a good approach to training. So I very much like he's a very big inspiration to me. But I had a really tough training session. I did a bench PB. And then nice. I had really difficult conditioning. And he came up to me at the end and he was like, you worked hard today. And I was like, do you know what? I did. And I worked hard because I wanted to do that for myself to feel good. And because I had the energy behind me, I'd slept well, like I'm looking after myself. So I was able to, it wasn't like you worked hard in like a destructive way. And he said to me, do hard things, live an easy life. Do easy things, live a hard life. And it stuck with me so much because I think in every sense of the world, it resonates. You know, that meal that feels like the hardest meal in the whole entire world for you to eat, you eating it now will make it easier to eat in the future. Or, you know, sitting and not going to the gym today because you have a compulsive relationship with exercise, but you're absolutely knackered. That will feel really hard right now. But then when you try and do it again, it will feel easier. You know, all of those things that feel so uncomfortable and difficult in the moment, by doing them now, you're going to make it easier for yourself down the line. And then, you know, in a few months, in a year, what have you, it will just become something that is second nature. But if you don't do it now, life is just going to continue to be really, really hard. And the eating disorder or disordered eating or whatever it is that's going on will just continue to thrive because you haven't been able to put in place, you know, things that allow you to rest, to recover, to look after yourself.
It's so true. It's so true. And I find it really frustrating that certain people within the health and wellness and fitness space who are quite predatory and have very destructive messages pirate sayings like that. They use, you know, easy things, hard life, hard things, easy life, during a message that they're giving that's all wrapped up in like toxic body image stuff or restrictive dieting or whatever. So I think it requires us to have a really well-practiced sense of wisdom and self-awareness to know when something really true is being said by someone who isn't using it in a helpful way. Because I speak to people all the time who are so sick of hearing certain things, but certain cliches and sayings that they are what they are for a reason because they're true. And yet a lot of the people that I've spoken with and even myself over the years, I've been turned off certain things just by how many times I heard it said by someone who didn't have my best interests at heart. So it's so important to be able to take these things that are 100% true, like, yes, this is true. And let's recognize when it's coming from a good place and someone who does have our best interests at heart versus when it's coming from someone who's maybe just trying to sell us something.
That's so true. Yeah. I guess my way of looking at it, it's like, at the end of the day, sometimes we need to hear things that we don't want to hear in order to be motivated or in order to kind of get the kick up the arse, I guess. Like, you know, you could very easily be like, just give it your best shot and, you know, just try. And yeah, that might be coming from a compassionate place, but particularly for somebody like me, that just doesn't work because it just feels like, oh, you know, I don't really need to try. And it's so funny because my therapist the other day, I was like, okay, I'm in a great place. Like, emotionally feeling good and all of this, like I'm eating enough, I've kind of weight restored, it's going well. And I was like, but I'm now at a point where, like, you know, if I go out for brunch or something, I'll just have eggs on toast because that's a safe option. But I'd like to be able to have like French toast or something. But I was like, I guess the extra calories I don't feel like I deserve because they're there for taste, not for like functionality. And so how do I get to a point where I can kind of, you know, go to the restaurant and choose the French toast? She was like, you just need to go and do it. And I was like, what? No, we need to do like weeks and weeks of processing. We need to really unpack this. You have to think about the emotions. And she was like, no, you've just got to go out, order the food and eat it. Then we'll do the processing. Then we'll think about how did you feel beforehand? How did you feel in the moment? How did you feel afterwards? But until you do it, we can't do any of that work. And I was just sat there like, I don't like this. Actually, she's so right. But I think sometimes, you know, things like that, you do need those motivational kind of quotes or that kind of thing. But like you say, it's the intention of where they're coming from. Things like pain is weakness leaving the body, or like, you know, you just got to keep pushing, like no boundaries, da da da, they probably don't have the best intentions. However, you know, if we take the pain is weakness leaving the body, like when, if you think about like in a therapy session, you know, you have to explore that pain in order to be able to unpack it and let it go. So I guess from one angle, it is true. It's just not maybe the most compassionate saying. And I think it has been adopted by people that are, you know, very compulsive and very kind of restrictive and rigid and things like that, which then isn't not maybe the most helpful going forward. But I think what I found is doing things that push my limits, but then reflecting on them afterwards. I think that's the really important piece is, yes, do things that are hard, do things that make you feel uncomfortable, do things that are tough, but reflect on them afterwards. You know, was that actually something that I needed to do in order to grow? How did that make me feel? And then kind of putting in some compassion for yourself afterwards to help yourself through that.
Yes. Any of my clients who hear this will laugh because I call that our post-game analysis.
Brilliant.
It's like we go and do the thing, we choose to do the hard thing, not just for no reason. We choose to do the hard thing to create an opportunity to practice responding to those difficult feelings and to give us an opportunity to do the post-game analysis. One of the most helpful things, it sounds so simple, but one of the most helpful things that was ever said to me was, it's normal for this phase of what you're doing to feel really scary. It would be weird if it wasn't. And I was going through some big changes when someone really special and important to me told me this. And he just said, by the way, the phase that you're in right now, like, this is really scary. It would make a lot of sense that you're experiencing that feeling right now. It's scary. You probably should be a little bit scared right now. It would be really weird if you weren't. And although that didn't take the fear away, that didn't make it less scary, I was then able to go, okay, so then me feeling kind of afraid or scared right now, this is actually a good sign. It's a sign that I'm doing the right thing. And that was just something that was so simple for me, but just it helped me feel a little bit more self-assured in that fear or while experiencing that phase of my own journey. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a really key point as well, in that often you will just kind of hear things and be like, ah, yep, that's, the penny has dropped. I now get it. I understand it. And I imagine from your perspective as a therapist, that must be so frustrating sometimes to be like, oh, they're just not quite getting there. But then the relief when you're like, oh, yes, the penny has now dropped. And okay, we're going down the right path now. That's brilliant. So yeah, I can imagine that that is such a rewarding moment when people are like, oh, you know, I've done this thing and it, you know, it's finally all coming together for me. But it does take time. And I think that's the difficult thing as well, is a lot of the time it feels that you're just banging your head against the wall, trying different things and nothing's happening, and then all of a sudden it just kind of falls together. And I don't want it to sound like, oh yeah, it's just all hippie and it all just kind of lands and it's beautiful. But yeah, I think it is having that patience and finding, you know, just kind of piecing things together slowly. And then you kind of build this bigger picture of, oh, okay, things are working for me now.
Wonderful friend of mine named Craig Lee, who's an exceptional eating disorder therapist. I think you guys know each other.
Yeah.
He was talking about the research behind what styles of support or intervention or therapy or whatever actually work for people. And the thing that I found just so wonderful about what he shared with me about this was that of all the different styles of therapy, different approaches, different, like there's myriad of different options that we have. There's no one method that's going to be better than another one. When we look at what works, the research backs up this idea that different things work for different people, and then different things work for somebody at different points in their life. So it's like the thing that maybe wasn't helpful for you at age 18 might become helpful at 27, and the thing that really wasn't helpful at 24 might then be the thing that changes your life at 38. So I'd really want to encourage from the bottom of my heart to anyone who's listening, because I've very much experienced this myself too, that if something didn't click with you at some point in your life, like, don't write it off just because it didn't help back then, because we all grow, we develop, and things, different tools do become more useful as we kind of travel our path. So yeah, I found that to be a really interesting bit from Craig.
Yeah. And I think it makes sense, doesn't it? Because especially on like a recovery journey, you know, you, the person that you arrive as, hopefully you're going to do a lot of like self-exploration and try different things. And, you know, I think for me particularly, when I first started my therapy this time around, I was significantly underweight. And, you know, didn't maybe have the mental capacity to explore things in a deep way. Whereas now that I'm weight restored, I've got that opportunity. I've got more energy. Like, I can think about things more differently. So different therapeutic methods have worked as we've gone along. But I think equally, you know, if you're not on like a weight restoration journey and you're just kind of like learning more about yourself, the more that you learn about yourself, the more that you can then explore things more deeply. So different therapeutic models might work in different instances. So I think that's a really great point. And not kind of, you know, just kind of shrugging something off because it didn't work for you before. Sounds like a great idea. So Marcus, yeah, it's been so lovely to chat to you. I feel like we've gone on such a different like exploration of what I was expecting, but so nice to unpack that all with you. And thank you for bringing your experiences in as well. Where can people go to find out more about you and the work that you do?
Thank you so much, Hannah. It's always really nice hanging out with you. Strong Not Starving on Instagram, Strong Not Starving on YouTube, and the Strong Not Starving podcast. It's just Strong Not Starving, one word, same thing across all those three platforms. The podcast is probably the biggest one that has over 100 episodes. YouTube, just because video editing takes so long.
Yes. It's so much more obvious as well than when you edit a podcast.
Yeah, my YouTube channel is quite small. There's not a whole lot of videos up on there because I'm, you know, putting energy in the podcast and writing a workbook at the moment and creating some different options for people and everything. But you'll find me on YouTube, Instagram, and all the major podcast platforms as Strong Not Starving.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Marcus, and it was a pleasure to speak to you again.
Always. Thanks, Hannah.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.